Blog Talk Radio.
Did I interrupt your bliss there? Hello, welcome to Masonic Effects. It's nothing like introducing a show with a little bit of King Oliver's band, 1924. And as I love to say, it may well be the very first time that Louis Armstrong showed the world what riffing on a trumpet sounded like. Until Louis. He's credited for this, and I like to believe it. Horns were part of an overall harmony, overall chord. And so you think about it, somebody had to make it a solo instrument. Why not? Why not this little guy in Louisiana? It was destitute on the street at about, what, 3 or 4 years old, or a little older, taken in by a Jewish family, as a matter of fact. And raised as part of their family, and I think did pretty well for himself. I think we can agree. Well, hello, Masonic Effects. We have an endless list of topics that we could get into, and I'm so distracted by the local surroundings here, but I know in my heart I want to, and in my mind I want to connect with some of the what I call the superlatives, places where masonry is being handled with being produced, created, would be a better word. From a more mature base than we have here, more thoughtful, more of a lot of things, but unique. I think it captures all of that. We haven't reached that point of awareness here, and I'm not sure I even understand how reaching that point of awareness would translate across an entire Grand Lodge. I don't know. I tend to think it starts as a small ember, as an ember, and then grows from there. But I know that with some the shift in some paradigm, the shift seems to be explosive, as if there was a backpressure and the certain ideas release that. And I'm thinking in my heart, here's the idealist. I'm thinking that's what I want for, and that's what I wish for here in this part of the Masonic framework. But I don't want to sound cynical, but my sense of reality is that would be very unusual, and the only way that we would accomplish that is with some major setback, major threat. Now that may well be the relevance of the masonry is being stretched in certain places, and it has been devalued. And, you know, we're talking about branding, you know, if you can imagine. Like, and the need to, it's good to focus on the messaging, but, you know, to equate it with a business opportunity, I think that's interesting. But I have that as a backdrop, and I don't know if I'm at the door of the Grand Lodge of Japan, would that be part of something that I would hear in those halls? Would I hear these types of discussions? May well be, and I suspected that we would be talking about the overall health of certain lodges and districts. And or prefects there, I would imagine, or guests. Would it be the same or similar conversation in the Grand Lodge of Russia or the Grand Lodge of India? Part of this would be familiar. A few years ago, I naively put my name, suggested to a fellow that I would talk to, be willing to talk to a gathering of Grand Masters. And I was... my message was about, you know, reconciliation. But on the ground, the brother was part of it was known to the organizers of this annual event. And whatever he put across came across as a bit too threatening to the Grand Masters, who said they turned down we were going to do a joint talk, which I thought made sense. But they turned it down, and they said that they didn't want to be lectured. And I thought that, you know, okay, I could understand in hindsight how they get that, but I didn't know. Maybe I wouldn't have put it across in a way that would have sounded lecturing or hectoring them. I would have my intent, and it is my style, unless I'm deliberately trying to create a bit of a shock and awe kind of thing, you know, sometimes is necessary. Wanting a point to find points of agreement and reason through some alternative strategies. They chose not, which I think is, I think that's rather revealing. And I don't think that this kind of thought is isolated. We will have people who, We deal with influences, and those influences in hindsight, we know whether they were effective and, you know, appropriate. At the time, we are deliberate in our approach, and the more qualified, and I say that broadly, the more qualified the people making those decisions, the better the outcome. So that doesn't say that some spontaneous initiative couldn't take hold, but it's a different situation when a lodge is working from a position of stability, and a big part of that stability is the intelligent conversation. Now, I know that's not always the case where the emphasis is in terms of emphasis. There are places where the emphasis is on resolving a problem. Here, we don't really take a look at who has the problem before assuming that we need an overarching authority to weigh in and settle things. Well, settling things around means that there's no closure. It's just a matter of I'll call it an intervention. If there's not compliance, then that's used as a justification to be punitive. Usually it's removing some right or access, basically. Beyond that, it doesn't leave any closure. The optics are very poor, and the estrangement with the participants is left lingering. Well, that's not just benign. That's tend to, as we can imagine, it tends in effect. The optics are poor, and where because we would expect a more thoughtful understanding, in depth and analysis of what's happening around us, and offer a path forward that doesn't rely on the use of authority or the excuse of authority. And I've been for a long time an adherent of the notion that the use of authority is a demonstration of the lack of leadership, an absence of leadership, not so much the lack, but an absence of leadership. We tend to anticipate the use of authority, so enforcement has become enormously important around where I am. And yet, critical thinking here, there is no separation between critical thinking and criticism, between constructive criticism and criticism aimed to undermine, the power and control type of thing. I would wonder that even in military and paramilitary organizations around my part of the world, there has been a shift away from a chain of command attitudes. Where we see this is most prominent, I think, most visible, is on the sports field, where we had I don't need to mention the countries. There were countries there and individualism was hailed as the be-all and end-all, everybody equal, clamoring by merit to rise to some level of eminence. However, we know that playing field has been skewed for a long, long, long time and continues to be. Now, the top down was an idea. It was almost like a deity kind of a thinking. I own you. I pay your hourly wage. Therefore, I own your time. Therefore, I dictate. And so we saw the growth of labor movements, very, very powerful labor movements, power that lingers in the background, in the back halls. That fell apart because it fell apart. The effect was far, far too expensive because it was demeaning. When you demean people, it is an instability. No matter where, we're seeing that on the international stage around us right now. Again, another display. Demeaning people, individual, group, culture, is always, always ends up in failure. Always. History. And I realize that some of you will be on that side of history that thinks if you don't learn from history, you risk repeating it. And those who say we never learn from history, and so we continuously repeat it. The failures and the costs were noticeable. Change was required. Part of it was some dirty little secrets. It was costing human lives. The suicide rates were suicide in my mind is a very cutting truth. What that truth is, I'll leave to you. But it is a truth. And when these power bases realized that they couldn't control that, they weren't talking to the scientists at all. They were looking at their own interests, and still do. Not exactly the most enlightened group of people, but a sliver of light thrown in on this phenomena, and it was reason, being able to engage somebody. And I could probably pull out a reference and track this, where it started or how it began, but I was not interested in that. Began to reason and find that when groups were committed to and felt that they were part of the same cause, the same purpose, the results were far, far better. And the example that's cited in this discussion around my circles is on the playing field around professional football, from ordering and demeaning and shaming players, sort of that ruthless grind. Well, you know, that's very stoic. Everybody had to go through that, to an engagement where you're dealing with the best of each member of your squad. Of course, not intending to be smug about it, but the results were far more sustainable and far better. The more so, it was happening to the extent that military organizations, very, very powerful military organizations, took a good look at their own internal threat assessments and continuing to bully and demean and break people's spirit. Remember that? Here in where I am in Canada, we save that for our prison system. Oh, yes, well, that's another day. You know, want to break people's spirit, because that's, after all, how you humanely treat people who have wrestled with psychiatric illness and the degradation of their start in life. Engagement, reasoning, talking, getting to know people, sharing values, those are things that mattered. And when things matter, people make an effort, they can commit. So that's where I am. So I don't mean to get off on that's just the backstory. We still in that happens culturally. There's some progress, not from any point of enlightenment, but from the bottom line, you know, the ledger. So where I am, money is profit is what our governments are most concerned about, and banking, big business, that type of thing, big pharma. Trickle down, or does it trickle up to what we were trying to do as a body of conscience, a group of men focusing their energies on awareness. If I said to you it's relative to the perspective of the individual, would you laugh at me? Would you be angry with me? There's so much diversity around the world, in our communities, within our lodges, and masonry for some interesting reason, has offered for a long time levels of principle and values and a smart awareness of ethics that has been championed in a very odd way. This isn't a group that goes and bangs a drum and toots a horn. It does, and the beauty of it is the idea that you're known by your actions, you're known by your behavior. I don't need to sit under the lotus tree to meditate, but you can. But I can find it internally within myself a ways to my means of meditation, where I have presence and focus and commune. For a body in the 21st century operating to this standard, it is a remarkably self-rewarding challenge. Now, looking around, I look around and think, well, it all makes sense. Of course, everybody that walks through the crowd, in the door, every initiative it doesn't have that shift in mindset. It might take can shift. I hope it does, because it's just such an interesting emotional experience had an initiation. But then this whole process of reasoning begins, and we hesitate over this value system. And it takes a while to understand the value system, particularly more so if we take away a culture that it symbolically and encourages the allegories. If you take that away, what a lot of men face. And it can be overwhelming, especially if they're when they come through the door, they aren't inclined to feel that they are omnipotent. They're not powerful. They may not understand. Of course, he does. We all can respect the effort and the intelligence that's required, or how we manufacture intelligence, what that means. Stop there. Today's show, good music. I'm doing it on an iPad, of all things, because my big computer has had a bit of a stroke, and I'm at the point of sorting out the next pieces of equipment. So I would like some feedback. Some of the fellows that know me well, is this coming across? Is it better than the last phenomena? When we inspire, that's our commentary. And the poetry today, I think, and it's just, again, every so often I just have indulgences. And this is one of them. This is, but for different reasons. This is from Rudyard Kipling, but for reasons that I think are relevant. It may be relevant to many of us today. Sit back and enjoy this. This is Red Garland. I Know Why. When we inspire, like many of you out there, I am grateful for the way masonry has affected me, adding a touch of old age that allows me to speak more truthfully and hopefully with decorum. I offer a proposition to change the way we define our relationships and invigorate our priority. Lodges are empty. Attendance is poor. For me, that raised the question of relevance and what have we done? If two old boys who walked away decades ago, as if they did something to contribute in their absence. The main current continues in one door out the other. It's a grimy business that we rationalize. Without solutions, we discourage conversations, and that keeps the cycle going. So much energy is invested trying to remodel men who show no interest in the study or understanding of Masonic methodology. Year by year, variations on the same themes are tried, but usually with the same results. We accept substandard work. We praise rather than encourage. And because we haven't a way to show them the consequences of sloth, we continue to invite that withering mindset into the craft because we were once as enthusiastic as a first date that ended badly. Our preoccupation with new members that struggle flatlines the heights our committed brethren might achieve had they received the same attention and concern. So I suggest we do that ourselves. Instead of chasing grown, disinterested adults, we show them why we invest by showing them what happens when we apply Masonic values. Hard teamwork and imagination. Hard work, teamwork. And we never look back. But we do. If we put our trust in a virtue, it's time to show the world what we can do when we stop rationalizing and get on with the task. No Mason needs permission to ask questions and to think. There never has been a box. Masonry explores. Our learning is discovery. We observe, we listen, we show patience. The others need a change to see it in action. Remembering that guilt isn't a motivation, we're still directed. The paradox is we can form a leadership that underlines the challenge, the antithesis, the paradox. We are, and I know it's not a magic wand, here's this book of virtue. Read it, therefore you're going to assume it, therefore you're going to act upon it. But no. If only the world was, I would not want the world to be that way. That's tyranny. Huh? Here's the book. But I will say that I think there's much to be learned by coming to terms with those virtues. We learn them partially. I don't think we necessarily jump into them with a sense of gleeful piety. But I was never really easy around people that are pious. I never really could trust them because I didn't understand them, frankly, and I still don't. I notice men of results. I notice Stoics. I notice maturity. I notice subtlety. I notice that confidence. When a person has influence and has power and doesn't need to demonstrate that. Oh, I'm not talking about the middle managers who are competing, you know, who's got the newest driver and putter, all that kind of stuff. They do what they do. But I'm looking for and they're all clamoring to be ahead. They're all clamoring to be that the boss, to be in that chair one day. And the person in the chair is watching and able to absorb. Is confident enough that they don't perform. They think, they reason, they talk. They are able to evaluate, not in a self-conscious kind of a way, but just as a matter of conversation, the way you and I do. How long does it take for us to determine whether we're talking to somebody that has some merit, has some capability, you know, to talk about whether they're overbearing and, you know, dilettante, or whether they are able to form their ideas and they have a degree of subtlety and aim about them. My goodness, just upsets the rules so much to be a Mason these days. But it doesn't upset all of us. There's a little cannonball Adderley. Beautiful. Poetry. Poetry again. It holds significance. I don't think I'm trying to convince you, just to describe and perhaps acknowledge, connect. Poetry holds significance for mature men as it offers a unique avenue for self-reflection, emotional expression, and a deeper exploration of life's complexities. It can provide solace, provoke thought, and connect individuals in shared human experiences. And nuance found in poetry often resonate with the nuanced perspective that come with maturity. Maturity brings a richness of experience that can be mirrored in the complexity of poetry, and it fosters a deeper connection with the art form. That's happened with me, for good or bad. I just have to, it wasn't always. The poem that I've selected is my indulgence. Sometimes I just need to hear, you know, the sentimental music. And this is my one of my sentimental poems. And it was first, I brought it up in a lodge, and quite unbeknown, it was on the wall of a very, very dear friend, Dave, out there. And Dave, in his practice, had this on the wall in his offices. It's Rudyard Kipling's If. This is a poem that Kipling was who he was, a product of his time. Yeah. The speaker is championing a morality built on moderation. Now, I don't know if I live that way all the time, but I want to, and I like the idea. It's very comforting. And I tend to think, as you reach a certain, when you reach this age, that there are a lot of compromises. And I find equivalencies between compromise and moderation in a way. Poem, the narrator, advises his son to move through life with composure. And so he's speaking to all of us. I mean, we were all sons, some color. And to always exercise self-control and integrity and humility. This is the easier said than done school of thinking. But the more you say it, the more you think it, the more you do it. So if we're going to repeat a mantra, this ain't bad. This means never letting triumph or disaster, events either good or bad, to go to one's head. And composure and self-restraint. Really, you notice the more you have self-control, the more power you have. The speaker implies it, composure and self-restraint. It makes it possible to act with dignity in all circumstances and to lead a respectable and virtuous life. It makes it possible, but is it feasible and plausible? You know, those are other things to consider. When the planets line up, it's like you have you ever had a perfect day in a way? Well, a perfect day just doesn't happen spontaneously. When you look for it or you're aware of it, they are there. And oddly, they're oddly there. But it's the plausibility. Do you accept the plausibility of this? No matter what happens, it's important that people keep their cool. And he tells his son just to keep his head about him, even when everybody is losing their composure. And not to respond to vitriol just because other people might hate him, for example. If you've ever been targeted, it's a terrible feeling. But when you don't know what to do, do nothing. That makes him think about this. You learn all of a sudden after that crushing blow to ego or that hurtful feeling, the discouragement. The eyes open and you begin to understand so much more about the people around you. Oh my, so much more about humanity. Yeah. So in here, the speaker is telling his son to devote himself calmly to rebuilding his life if it ever goes to shambles. And encourages him to remain reasonable and diligent, even through tough times. Like, don't lose the faith. Just keep focused. Do what you can. And you, if you think about it, even now, if you project yourself into that kind of circumstance, it's easy to rehearse this in your mind now when you're feeling confident and you're comfortable than to try it when you're in those circumstances, when you're up to your hips in alligators. It's just not the time to start to think this way. It's just overwhelming. Not to say you can't or you haven't, but hindsight is 20/20. So he's essentially speaking, telling us that people need to find a happy medium between confidence and modesty. And so let's, the idea is that composure leads to strength and integrity. So We will get into the Edwardian era, speaker of if manhood isn't something one is born with, but a quality one earns. But you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you. But make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give away to hating, and yet don't look too good nor talk too wise. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostures just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken and stoop and build them worn-out tools, if you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it all in one turn of pitch and toss and lose and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue or walk with kings, nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it, and which is more, you'll be a man, my son. You can trust yourself when all men doubt. Not only easier said than done, but it's after you absorb the blow, then you're reminded, this is the lesson. You only learn this lesson when you're at that point. I wish it was easier. Hey? Sometimes I really do. I can't tell you how interesting it's been going through the minutes of this Dutch lodge from 18th century, La Bien Ami. Not so much thinking about restoring, restorative nostalgia. I'm not that kind of believer. Reflective. What does it tell us? What do we learn? We learn about influence, but I would never want anybody to think that the predominant influence was orchestrated and delivered by any Grand Lodge. Here we're seeing illustrations of intellectual exchange of ideas, currency, trade, science, and the arts, culture. Is really what we're talking about when we start to reflect. And here, we've been looking at this for some time, almost 2 years now, something like that. Le bien prepares. We are looking at a precarious time in history, not only of the Dutch, but world history. And just as a backstop, I want to give you a sense. I'll try and do it as politely as I can. This is from at arm's length. This is from Wikipedia. We usually look for something from Oxford or Britannia, that type of thing. Not to belittle this, but it's just succinct. A in the history of the Dutch Republic, Orangism was a political force opposing the Staatsunvijd, which is the pro-republic party. Orangists supported the princes of Orange as stadtholders. And that was a position held by members of the House of Orange and military commanders of the republic as a check on the power of the regenten. The Orangist party drew its adherents largely from traditionalists, mostly farmers and soldiers, noblemen, and Orthodox Protestant preachers, weighted heavily over the course of the Republic's history. And there were never clear-cut socioeconomic divisions. Now, let me move on here. There was an invasion. Of course, William III was born on the 4th of November, 1650, a Dutchman by birth, part of the House of Orange, and he would later reign as King of England, Scotland, and Ireland until his death in 1702. His reign came at a precarious time in Europe when religious divide dominated international relations. William would emerge as an important Protestant figurehead. The Orange Order in Northern Ireland is named after him. His victory at the Battle of Boyne, 12th of July, is still celebrated by many in Northern Ireland, Canada, and parts of Scotland. The William story begins in the Dutch Republic, and he was born in The Hague. He was the only child of William II, the Prince of Orange, and his wife Mary. Now, you're wondering the connection. Mary also happened to be the eldest daughter of King Charles the First of England. Yes, the one that the books on regicide are written about. He was beheaded. And he was a bit of him. He wasn't exactly the most delicate. He had that godlike quality about the king, and we know what happened there. And then his son, Charles II, what was that, 11 or 12 years later? Unfortunately, William's father, the prince, died 2 weeks before William was born, resulting in him assuming the title of Prince of Orange from birth. And he grew up being tutored by various governesses and later received lessons, daily lessons, from a Calvinist preacher called Cornelius Trein. These lessons instructed him about the destiny he was to fulfill as part of divine providence. William was born into royalty, and he had a role to fulfill. When he was 10 years old, his mother died of smallpox while she was visiting her brother in England. And in her will, Mary wished her brother Charles II to take care of William's interests. This was contentious, as his general education and upbringing was brought into question by those who supported the dynasty and others in the Netherlands who supported a more republican system. In the years that followed, the English and Dutch would continue to jostle for influence over the young royal, to the point at which in the Second Anglo-Dutch War, one of the peace conditions included an improvement in William's position, as requested by his uncle Charles II in England. For the young William back in the Netherlands, he was learning to be an astute autocrat, entitled to rule. His roles were twofold, leader of the House of Orange and stadtholder. That's a Dutch word referring to the head of state of the Dutch Republic. This proved very, very difficult due to the Treaty of Westminster, which ended the First Anglo-Dutch War. And in the treaty, Oliver Cromwell demanded the Act of Seclusion be passed, forbidding Holland to appoint a member of the Royal House of Orange to the role of stadtholder. However, the impact of the English Restoration meant that the act was voided, allowing William to attempt to once again assume the role. His first attempts did not go well. By the time he was 18, the Orangist Party were making a concerted effort to secure William's role as stadtholder and captain general, whilst the leader of the States Party, De Witt, allowed for an edict which declared that the two roles could never be held by the same person in any province. Nevertheless, De Witt was unable to suppress William's rise to power, especially when he became a member of the Council of State. But in the meantime, international conflict was brewing across the water, with Charles making an agreement with his French allies for an imminent attack on the Republic. The threat forced those in the Netherlands who had been resistant to William's power to concede and allow him to assume the role of States General for the summer. The year 1672, for many in the Dutch Republic, proved to be devastating. So much so, it became known as the Disaster Year. It was the Dutch-Franco War, the Third Anglo-Dutch War, whereby the country was invaded by France and France's allies, which at the time included England, Cologne, and Munster. The ensuing invasion had a great impact on the Dutch people, who were appalled at the presence of a French army at the heart of their beloved republic. The result for many was to turn their backs on the likes of De Witt and become William, and welcome William as stadtholder on the 9th of July. A month later, William published a letter from Charles which demonstrated that the English king had instigated war due to the aggression of De Witt and his men. De Witt and his brother Cornelius were fatally attacked and murdered by civilian militia loyal to the House of Orange. This allowed William to introduce his own supporters as regents. His involvement in the lynching was never fully established, but his reputation was somewhat damaged by the violence and barbarity used that day. Now, in a strong position, William took control and continued to fight off the threat from the English and French. And in 1677, he tried through diplomatic measures to improve his position through his marriage to Mary, the daughter of the Duke of York, who would later become King James II. This was a tactical move which he anticipated would allow him to acquire Charles' kingdoms in the future and both influence and redirect the French-dominated policies of the English monarchy towards a more favorable Dutch position. As Le Bien-Ami prepares to welcome in the new century, the minutes reflect the sense of business as usual. The heady and emotional rhetoric of the early 1790s gives way to charitable collections in 1799 for those afflicted by the serious floods of that year, and to the ongoing project of codification and unification. Progress is made with the National Assembly of the Batavian people in gaining legal recognition for Dutch lodges, something that had never been possible before the Revolution, no matter how many distinguished men joined the lodges. If the people still objected to their secretive ways or imagined the lodges as centers for their liberty, their objections go unrecorded, and proceedings which in the past had been sensitive to any and all slanders. In the face of poor attendance, new fines were imposed with officers now subject to higher penalties than members. Procedures for elections are changed to, quote, ensure the free elections not in appearance, but in reality, end quote, and are allowed to occur. If these brothers felt the profound disillusionment that many a Dutch Republican came to feel in relation to their French occupiers, the minutes, at least up to 1800, are silent. For better or worse, this is a new order that to many brothers had worked to assist into being. They had worked for. The general principles of the Batavian Republic were closer to their ideals than the regime it had so suddenly and irretrievably replaced. Dutch Freemasonry began officially in the 1730s with a distinctively orangist cast, which it would never lose. Some lodges in Middelburg, for example, were heavily oligarchic in their composition and utterly resisted the lure of both the late 18th century Dutch revolutions. Town built up originally on the wealth of the Atlantic trade, the homes of patriots were plundered. and the slaveholding colonies, whole lodges, were composed of the leaders of the Dutch India, East India Company in Suriname. The first lodge opened in 1773. That in Curaçao earlier in 1757. Indeed, Dutch republicanism, although influenced by late Enlightenment arguments against slavery, never aspired to its actual abolition in the Dutch colonies. The system was just too profitable. And the fear of slave rebellion, such as occurred in the brutal slave colony of Suriname in the 1770s, was too fresh. Patriots occasionally condemned slavery or sought the natural rights of Dutch citizens governed by the harsh trading companies. But the Dutch Revolution never went so far as the French in proclaiming the rights of all men. A step in history. Masonry is not the predominant issue during these times, is it? We're reflecting on a different context, on the effects, the internal workings of the lodge. Now, if we're prone to judgment, we get very little out of this, I think. If we are sitting here with mind looking to understand what was going on, I think there's a great deal to be gained that impacts our thinking to this very, very day. But that appears to be it. I see the time, the clock has wound down again. I appreciate you sitting in and joining us today. I hope it's been useful, informative, entertaining at least. I'll look for you next week. I do need some feedback about this production on this, iPad, but I intend to make this temporary. The world needs moderation these days, not necessarily fist pounding to proclamations, but men capable of persuasion, capable of listening and absorbing what these firebrands are saying at each other. We can do very little about the about extremism, except we can increase the volume of the voice of moderation. And it's trying times, but we've just been reading about trying times hundreds of years old, so that seems to be part of the human condition. I hope you'll be frank and with yourself, that you'll continue to treat the world as brethren, with the same understanding that you and I would expect from one another. Take that kind of leadership and influence. Commit acts of random Masonic kindness. And by all means, include yourself. We'll see you again soon.